accession number 27344, wheel 14.
Roman Candleless, wheel 14.
Anyway, after leaving Caldrose behind, I had an appointment to join 801 Squadron at Leon Solent. And we were going to be working up to join HMS Indomitable and then go on to Korea afterwards. So anyway, we were at Leon Solent and I joined 801 and I quite enjoyed it. We were really enjoying life there quite a lot. And I was going out with a Wren and I was determined that I wasn't going to get involved before I went off to Korea. And I suppose we were there for about 6 weeks. And we got an appointment to fly out. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. To join the Indomitable. And we went off in the Indomitable down through the Bay of Biscay to Gibraltar. And we stopped in Gibraltar while we did flying exercises in the western end of the Mediterranean. And one of the exercises we were doing was giving the aircraft direction officers in the ship practice in directing aircraft. And what we did was the Fireflies would act as bombers and the Sea Furies would act as the fighters being directed onto them. And I was flying a pair of Sea Furies and I was number two. And we were flying about 15,000 feet. And the directors called us up and said there were bandits approaching from a particular direction and gave us a steer to intercept them. So we went off on this direction and then we saw the Fireflies and sort of gave the usual call of tally-ho. And then my leader positioned himself for attack and we were going to attack with camera guns. And we got above them and started to turn in and he went off and I gave him about 5 seconds start and then I turned in. And I opened the throttle a bit to get some speed on. And as I was going down, just turning in onto the Fireflies, I suddenly found myself completely out of control. I had no control on the rudders and the aileron weren't effective and I was in a very violent spin. And when I'd found that I couldn't control it, I decided I had to bail out. So I jettisoned the hood and then released the harness so that I could climb out. And as I put my arms up to grab the front of the top of the windscreen to pull myself up, my right arm was blown back over my head and over the back of the cockpit. And my head was blown over the back of the cockpit. And I couldn't see into the cockpit because of the wind speed. But I found that I couldn't get out. I was trapped. And I couldn't see what it caught. So what I did was I put my feet in the bucket seat and pushed until something broke and I just popped free. So then I pulled the parachute and then it opened comfortably and I sat in the parachute and watched my aircraft crash below me. So then I looked around and I could see the Fireflies had seen what happened and they were circling around me, so I knew that there'd be a report of what was happening. So as I went down, the practice is in parachuting that if you're going into water, you release the parachute just as your feet are touching the water so that the parachute will drift away from you and you won't get caught up in the shroud lines. So as I got down, I turned the... there's a disc that you turn and then hit to release the parachute harness. So I turned the disc, ready to give it a slap. And then when I got down to the right height, I tried to hit it and found that I couldn't hit it because my right arm wasn't working properly. So I went into the water with the parachute still on. So the first thing I did then was to blow up my Mae West, sort of give me some flotation. And the parachute settled down round me, and the shroud lines went down. And of course, as I was swimming, my legs were getting tied up with the shroud lines. And I tried to press the button again, the disc again, to get rid of the parachute harness. But by this time, the water had got into the harness and it was starting to get tighter. And I still couldn't use my right arm properly, and I wasn't quite sure why. So I thought, well, it's bloody stupid to get this far and then drown. I've really got to get rid of this thing. So I curled up into sort of fetal size under the water, and using both hands, I managed to squeeze the disc and release the harness. And as soon as I released it, it went straight down because it was all totally waterlogged. And there was a lanyard from my Mae West to the dinghy. And usually what happens is that the dinghy slides free from the parachute and lets the parachute go, and you're left with the dinghy on the end of a lanyard floating beside you. But in this case, somehow, the dinghy didn't free itself from the parachute. So the parachute was waterlogged and getting heavier and heavier and pulling me down. So in the end, I had to release the lanyard and let the dinghy go with the parachute. So there I was, left with just the Mae West sitting around. And the firefly came down over me at regular intervals just to show me that they were still there. And of course, they had radioed back to the ship, and the ship's destroyer was sent to pick me up. We were, I suppose, about 20 miles. So I was in the water for a bit over an hour, and then I could see a pall of black smoke on the horizon where the destroyer was coming at full speed. And then I could see the bow. And then I could see the bow wave coming straight at me. Thought, God, I hope they can see me and stop in time. But by this time, the fireflies were coming down over me regularly to let the destroyer see where I was. So the destroyer pulled up short, I suppose about 200 yards away, and lowered their seaboat. And the seaboat's crew rowed over to me to pick me out. And they came alongside me and grabbed me to pull me into the boat. And unfortunately, they were pulling me in with my right arm. So I persuaded them to let go. So they were somewhat surprised and dropped me back in again, and I explained to them what was wrong. So they were a bit more gentle, and instead of using my arms, they pulled me in using the life jacket. And they got me into the boat and back to the destroyer. And then I walked down to a cabin in the destroyer, and the medical officer in the destroyer gave me an injection of some kind, and I went to sleep. And I wakened up to feel myself being jostled around and some very bad language going on around me. And I wondered what on earth it was. So I looked around, and I was on a stretcher. And there was four ratings trying to get me out of this cabin and turned into a narrow passageway. And there's no way they could have done it. So I said, wait a minute. So I stepped off the stretcher, and they took it out into the passage. And then I stepped back on, and they took me up to transfer me back to the carrier. So anyway, I got back to the carrier, and I wasn't very popular because I had caused a mid-air collision with my number one. I'd overtaken him in the dive. And anyway, they said I would have to see the captain for the captain's inquiry. But before that, the young doc, a lieutenant, not very experienced, said he would put my shoulder back in where it was dislocated. And he said, what I'll do is I'll give you an injection of pentothal, which will help, and then I'll put it back in. And he said, with pentothal, the practice is that I start to inject and you start to count. And by the time you get to 10 or thereabouts, you should be going out. And when you're out, I'll know you've gone because you'll stop counting. I said, OK. So he started to inject. And I got to about 30 and still nothing happening. And we were going on, and I was up to over 60. I said to him, "You callous bastard." And he didn't know whether to stop injecting or to carry on or what to do. And at 64, I went out chunking like a light. Anyway, he put my shoulder back in. And then I was wearing a sling when I went to see the captain the next day. And I explained what had happened. And I discovered during the investigation that my leader, after he'd turned in to attack, instead of keeping his speed up, had throttled back so that he could take a longer picture of the aircraft. So he'd throttled back and I'd increased my speed. So I overtook him in the turn and my tail unit hit his starboard main plane. So his main plane was a bit damaged to the extent that he didn't feel he could land back in the ship. So he flew back to North Front in Gibraltar and landed there. Anyway, the captain decided that it was over-enthusiasm on my part and it didn't justify a court-martial. So I was put ashore in Gibraltar and then flown back to Hasler, the naval hospital at Gosport. So I was in the naval hospital and they discovered that when I had been swimming in the water and doing all that I was doing, the dislocated end of the bone had mashed the nerve to this muscle. So the muscle at the top of my arm was paralysed. And they said, well, the nerve will grow again, but it'll take some time. And when it does, you'll have the full use of your arm again. So instead of taking up a bed in the hospital, we'll send you to a convalescent home. So I was sent with another lieutenant to Osborne House on the Isle of Wight. And this was a convalescent home for officers and senior civil servants. And when we got there, I'm sure we brought the average age down to about 76. And there were some lovely nurses there. So we had a thoroughly good time. And my physiotherapy was entirely sawing wood for the house. And I sawed wood every day for the fires in Osborne House. But it seemed to work, and I got the use of my arm back quite quickly. And then I was sent back to Hasler when they reckoned that all was well. And all I would need to do would be exercises to get my arm back to full strength. So I was back in Hasler, and there was another lieutenant in the bed next to me. He was another pilot. Can't remember what was wrong with him. But he said, I've got a date tonight and she's bringing another girl with her. Would you like to accompany me on a blind date? So I said, okay. So off we went. And we had a very nice date. We thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. And I took a real shine to his girlfriend. So when he pushed off from Hasler, I took over. And I was then at Leon Solent again for another 4 or 5 weeks, again back in 801 Squadron, and again working up for Korea.
Could I ask about one aspect of this that maybe we haven't discussed? Really fighter tactics, because you mentioned obviously at Streatham that you did formation aerobatics, but had you learned at any stage the fighter tactics, because they're slightly different from what you were flying with the Barracuda?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all the flying that we were doing in the RNVRs, when we were in the fighters, we were doing fighter work as taught by the RN lieutenant in the squadron. I mean, he always flew with us, and he taught us the fighter tactics. And then, of course, when I went to Streatham, it was all fighters there. So once again, it was fighter tactics there. And then at Caldrose, once again, fighter tactics. So we were well up in it by that time.
Are there any things about fighter tactics that you could describe? You know, the kind of basic principles that you have to adhere to?
Well, the thing is, in those days, we were firing either machine guns or cannons. And to hit the target, you had to get as close as you dared. You really couldn't fire long range and expect to hit the target. Now, when you're aiming at an aircraft that's flying, that aircraft, you've got to estimate its speed. So you've got to estimate how far ahead of it to aim, so that when your bullets get there, it gets there at the same time. And this is built into the sight you're using. And it's a gyroscopic sight. And you fly around till you position yourself ahead of the target. My wife will do it. You fly to position yourself ahead and above. So if the target's flying towards you, you're flying in the opposite direction. And then you turn in, so that you come in as tight a turn as you can, as close as you can, and aiming to get your gun sight ahead of the target sufficiently far for the bullets and the target to reach the same point in the air at the same time. And the thing about that is that you really have to get quite close, almost frighteningly close. And when we were training fighter pilots on towed targets, it was surprising how difficult it was to persuade them to get close enough. Of course, mark you, some of them made mistakes and carried it away, but it really was a matter of getting as close as you dared in order to shoot it down. And the whole idea was to get in a position ahead of it so you could get this curve of pursuit, as you'd call it, which was coming round on the beam of the aircraft, turning in on its stern, but not being too far away. And it was a thing which you learn quite quickly, really.
When you say close, how close would you say?
Oh, well, I would say 400 yards was the maximum, and if you could get down to 200 yards comfortably, then you could be not certain, but fairly sure that you were going to hit the target.
And if you'd attacked a target, what's the next move? Do you go above or below or away from?
Depends on your approach. Generally speaking, if you were in a hard turn to port, you would then break to starboard and turn back again and see what had happened to your target, if anything. But of course, like the Battle of Britain pilots have always said, you can't concentrate on one target and ignore what's behind you. So having attacked and fired, you were making a break to make sure no one was going to fire at you. And it was just a matter of breaking away from the attack so that you were going to avoid it. And if it exploded, try to avoid the debris. And just you could go under, over or round. Just whatever was convenient at the time.
Because I imagine the closing speeds, you would have very little time to identify things.
Well, again, this was going back to identification. I remember I spoke about aircraft recognition when we were down to photographic flash timing. So that was the length of time you needed to recognise an aircraft. But again, depending on the speed of the target, if it was a fast target, you had to turn in quite a long way ahead of it so that it wasn't going to get away from you. If it was a slow target, you could manoeuvre around it quite comfortably. But as you say, if it was a fast target, then you really were pushed to get into the right position. And you might well find yourself firing at 90 degrees to his line of flight. And if you're firing at 90 degrees to his line of flight, that's the maximum deflection. And it's not easy to get the right deflection to hit him. So it's easier to get round astern. And the nearer line astern you are, the more likely you are to hit the target. So if it's a very fast target, you can bet your bottom dollar that he's likely to get away because your best shot is likely to be from the beam. There's no doubt that firing at another aircraft with machine guns or cannons was an art more than a science. But that's why the Spitfires and the Hurricanes during the Battle of Britain did quite well against the bombers, but not so well against the fighters, because they're almost matching speeds, you see. And that's a very tricky situation to get into.
Because it sounds obviously from the tactics that you'd get, that you were being taught at that stage as well, that really you may only have got one opportunity to fire an aircraft.
Absolutely. If it was another fighter aircraft, unless he was trying to attack you, you would only get the one attempt. But with bombers, again, if the bombers were escorted, you might only get one pass at the bomber because there'd be fighters chasing you. Yes, with that weapon in the air, it was difficult to shoot things down. The firing against towed targets, it was amazing how low a percentage of the bullets actually hit the target. But there you are. Those are the weapons we had, and we had to do the best we could with them.
I mean, it seems quite strange, obviously, that I think to the layman that would be the case, that only a few bullets would hit a target like that. But is that the combination of all the factors that you've been talking about coming together to actually get a good shot on a target?
Absolutely, yeah. As I say, if you're firing from the beam with maximum deflection, I think your chances were down to perhaps 1 or 2%. But from astern, you could probably say they went up to 15 to 20%. But it was never, ever anywhere near 100%. Never. And those who were shooting down lots of aircraft during the war, the Battle of Britain and that sort of thing, they had luck on their side as well as skill, just to be managing to get themselves into the right position. Because it wasn't always skill that got you there.
Because, of course, the Sea Fury would have been a much more powerful aircraft even than the Second World War aircraft, or even the Sea Fire.
Yeah, oh yes. It was just about the fastest piston-driven aircraft. I think there might have been one or maybe two of the American ones that was faster, but it was a great aircraft to fly, and I thoroughly enjoyed flying it. I flew it out in Korea, and it was a really marvellous, rugged machine to fly in those circumstances.
You mentioned something about a slight problem with landing on carriers.
I did, that's quite right. when the aircraft was flying at the stall, if you can imagine, the aircraft nose is coming up and up as you come closer to the stall. And then at the stall, if you have the main wheels and the tail wheel on the same level, then you can just touch down and run along the ground. But in the case of the Sea Fury, when the aircraft was at the stall, the tail wheel was still a foot or 18 inches above the ground, as it were. So that if you touched the ground at the stall, you would almost certainly bounce off the main wheels, and you would bounce with the nose going up. So you would stall quickly then and come back down with a thump. But in that interval between bouncing and coming down, you were in the barrier. I did describe the barrier to you before, didn't I? So that was the thing, that with the Sea Fury, there was just this possibility of getting a bounce in the wires and going over the wires into the barrier. And in fact, I did do that on my 364th deck landing. I went into the barrier and I was bloody cross, because there was a whole group of senior officers from the Army and the Air Force and a whole batch of Wrens standing up in the Goofers Gallery watching, and I couldn't have been more cross.
And that was that just a circumstance of that particular landing?
Yes, it was just that I misjudged it and bounced. And there is certainly an art in landing. Again, you see, it's a big nose, a 14-foot nose, and it is a radial engine, which means at the front of the engine, it's at its broadest. So when you're coming round to land, you've got to come round in a continuous curve, so you're looking down beside the engine at the deck, and in the last 50 yards or so, you're straightening up, so you're touching down with the wings level, the main wheels and the tail wheel, all the same place at the same instant. And it didn't always work.
With the bouncing into the barrier, was there a kind of a pride amongst your fellow officers not to do that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In the early days, when aircraft were flying regularly, you could bet your bottom dollar that there'd be a lot of people standing up on the island watching what was going on, because the chances are there was going to be at least a barrier prying, if not something else. Of course, there are all sorts of accidents on the flight deck. I mean, people would stall early and go off to one side, and they could go off either to starboard or to port. If they went off to starboard, then they would fall over the side and into the sea, and if they went off to port, they'd make the batsman jump out of the way, and they could go into the sea again, or they could hang in the guns over the side of the ship. And there was one accident after the war with an aircraft called the Wyvern, when he made such a mess of his approach that he finished up, and I'm not exaggerating, on top of the funnel. That's where the Wyvern finished up. I don't know how that happened or what happened afterwards, but that's where he finished up. And the number, of course, that crashed into the island was quite large. Some actually hopped over the barriers and landed in the deck park of aircraft up the front. And in fact, when HMS Ocean was working up to come out to Korea to relieve Glory, they did have an incident where one of the Fireflies leapt over the barrier into the forward park and wrote off something like 8 or 10 aircraft and killed a number of the people who were amongst the aircraft. So that squadron had to be reformed before they came out to Korea. So we were kept out in Korea for another month or so, waiting for that squadron to reform and work up again. But those are the sort of really serious accidents that could occur.
Was there an increase with the more powerful aircraft of accidents? No,
because we were getting better at it by then. And there's no doubt that with the more powerful aircraft, you have better control. And if you get into an awkward position and you open the throttle, then you can get away from it. So in any case, as I say, we were all getting better at it. And, altogether, I think I must have done nearly 600 deck landings. And just, you were confident that you were going to be able to do it well. And it might be on that 364th that I was overconfident. You never know, it's just one of those things. No, we didn't have as many accidents then as we had earlier on. And certainly when we got into flying jets to and from carriers, far fewer accidents, because you had a far better view. Because you're sitting right up at the front, there was no nose in front of you.